Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Well, something I'll remember my whole life is being here tonight. This is our anniversary, Anne. And this is the first time that I've read in America from this novel. So this is my debut, and I can think of no place I'd rather be in the whole world. So it's. I'm going to read, and then I'll take questions afterwards. The part I'm going to read is my hero, who's at this point in the book a little 13-year-old boy. His mother has died in an accident, and he's in a bit of a state of shock, and it's in the middle of the night, and some social workers have come by to get him in the apartment because he's there by himself. The social workers put me in the back seat of their compact car and drove me to a diner downtown near their work, a fake grand place glittering with beveled mirrors and cheap Chinatown chandeliers. Once we were in the booth, both of them on one side, with me facing, they took clipboards and pens from their briefcases and tried to make me eat some breakfast while they sat sipping coffee and asking questions. It was still dark outside. The city was just waking up. I don't remember crying or eating either, though all these years later, I can still smell the scrambled eggs they ordered for me. The memory of that heaped plate with the steam coming off it still ties my stomach in knots. The diner was mostly empty. Sleepy busboys unpacked boxes of bagels and muffins from behind the counter. A wan cluster of club kids with smudged eyeliner were huddled in a nearby booth. I remember staring over at them with a desperate, clutching attention. A sweaty boy in a Mandarin jacket, a bedraggled girl with pink streaks in her hair, and also at an old lady in full makeup and a fur coat much too warm for the weather, who was sitting by herself at the counter, eating a slice of apple pie. The social workers, who did everything but shake me and snap their fingers in my face to get my attention, seemed to understand how unwilling I was to absorb what they were trying to tell me. Taking turns, they leaned across the table and repeated what I did not want to hear. My mother was dead. She had been struck in the head by flying debris. She had died instantly. They were sorry to be the ones who broke the news. It was the worst part of their job, but they really, really needed me to understand what had happened. My mother was dead, and her body was at New York Hospital. Did I understand? Yes, I said, in the long pause where I realized they were expecting me to say something. Their blunt, insistent use of the words death and dead was impossible to reconcile with their reasonable voices, their polyester business clothes, the Spanish pop music on the radio, and the peppy signs behind the counter. Fresh fruit smoothie, diet delight, try our turkey hamburger. Fritos, said the waiter, appearing at our table, holding aloft a big plate of French fries. Both social workers looked startled. The man of the pair, first names only, Enrique, said something in Spanish and pointed a few tables over where the club kids were gesturing to him. Sitting red-eyed in my shock before my rapidly cooling plate of scrambled eggs, I could scarcely grasp the more practical aspects of my situation. In light of what had happened, their questions about my father seemed so wholly beside the point that I had a hard time understanding why they kept asking so insistently about him. So, when's the last time you saw him? Said the Korean lady, who'd asked me several times to call her by her first name. I've tried and tried to recall it, but I can't. I can still see her plumpish hands folded on the table, though, and the disturbing shade of her nail polish. an ashen, silvery color, something between lavender and blue. "A guesstimate?" prompted the man Enrique. "About your dad?" "Ballpark will do," the Korean lady said. "When do you think you last saw him?" It was an effort to think. "Sometime last fall? My mother's death still seemed like a mistake that might be straightened out somehow if I pulled myself together and cooperated with these people. October? September," she said gently when I didn't respond. My head hurt so badly I felt like crying whenever I turned it, although my headache was the least of my problems. I don't know," I said, "after school started." "September, would you say, then?" asked Enrique, glancing up as he made a note on his clipboard. He was a tough-looking guy, uneasy in his suit and tie, like a sports coach gone to fat. But his tone conveyed a reassuring sense of the 9-to-5 world, office filing systems, industrial carpeting, business as usual in the borough of Manhattan. "No contact or communication since then?" "Who's a buddy or close friend who might know how to reach him?" said the Korean lady, leaning forward in a motherly way. The question startled me. I didn't know of any such person. Even the suggestion that my father had close friends, much less buddies, conveyed a misunderstanding of his personality so profound I didn't know how to respond. It was only after the plates had been taken away, in the edgy lull after the meal was finished, but no one was getting up to leave, that it crashed down on me all at once where all their seemingly irrelevant questions about my father and my Decker grandparents in Maryland, I couldn't remember the town, some semi-rural subdivision behind a Home Depot, and my non-existent aunts and uncles had been so plainly leading. I was a minor child without a guardian. I was to be removed immediately from my home, or the environment, as they kept calling it. Until my father's parents were contacted, the city would be stepping in. "But what are you going to do with me?" I asked for the second time, pushing back in my chair, a crackle of panic rising in my voice. It had all seemed very informal when I'd turned off the television and left the apartment with them for a bite to eat, as they'd said. Nobody had said a word about removing me from my home. Enrique glanced down at his clipboard. "Well, Teo," he kept pronouncing it Teo, they both did, which was wrong, "you're a minor child in need of immediate care. We're going to need to place you in some kind of emergency custody." Custody? The word made my stomach crawl. It suggested courtrooms, locked dormitories, basketball courts ringed with barbed wire fence. "Well, let's say care, then. And only until your grandma and grandpa..." "Wait," I said, overwhelmed at exactly how fast things were spinning out of control, at the false assumption of warmth and familiarity in the way he'd said the words grandma and grandpa. "We'll just need to make some temporary arrangements until we reach them," said the Korean lady, leaning close. Her breath smelled minty, but also had the slightest underbite of garlic. "We know how sad you must be, but there's nothing to worry about. Our job is just to keep you safe until we reach the people who love you and care about you, okay?" It was too awful to be real. I stared at the two strange faces across the booth, sallow in the artificial lights. Even the proposition that Grandpa Decker and Dorothy were people who cared about me was absurd. "But what's going to happen to me?" I said. "The main concern," said Enrique, "is that you're in a capable foster situation for the time being, with someone that'll work hand in hand with social services to implement your care plan. Their combined efforts to soothe me, their calm voices and sympathetic, reasonable expressions, made me increasingly frantic. "Stop it," I said, jerking away from the Korean lady who had reached over across the table and was attempting to clasp my hand in a caring way. "Look, Teo, let me explain something. Nobody's talking about detention or a juvenile facility." "Then what?" "Temporary custody. All that means is we take you to a safe place with people who will act as guardians for the state." "What if I don't want to go?" I said, so loudly that people turned to stare. Listen, Enrique said, leaning back and signaling for more coffee. The city has certified crisis homes for youth in need. Fine places. And right now, that's just one option we're looking at. Because in a lot of cases like yours, I don't want to go to a foster home. Kid, you sure don't, the pink-haired club girl said audibly at the next table. Recently, the New York Post had been full of Jonte and Kashawn Divins, the 11-year-old twins who had been raped by their foster father and starved nearly to death up around Morningside Heights. Enrique pretended not to hear this. Look, we're here to help, he said, refolding his hands on the tabletop. And we'll also consider other alternatives if they keep you safe and address your needs. You never told me I couldn't go back to the apartment. Well, city agencies are overburdened. Sí, gracias, he said to the waiter who'd come to refill his cup. But sometimes other arrangements can be made if we get provisional approval, especially in a situation like yours. What he's saying? The Korean lady tapped her fingernail on the formica to get my attention. It's not set in stone if you go into the system if there's somebody who can come stay with you for a little while, or vice versa. A little while, I repeated. It was the only part of the sentence that had sunk in. Like, maybe there's somebody else we could call that you might be comfortable staying with for a day or two. Like a teacher, maybe. Or a family friend. Off the top of my head, I gave them the telephone number of my old friend Andy Barber, the first number that came to me, maybe because it was the first phone number beside my own I'd learned by heart. Though Andy and I had been good friends in elementary school, movies, sleepovers, summer classes in Central Park, and map and compass skills, I'm still not quite sure why his name was the first to fall out of my mouth, since we weren't such good friends anymore. We'd drifted apart at the start of junior high. I'd hardly seen him in months. Barber with a U, said Enrique as he wrote the name down. Who are these people? Friends? Yes, I replied. I'd known them all my life, practically. The Barbers lived on Park Avenue. Andy had been my best friend since third grade. His dad has a big job on Wall Street, I said, and then I shut up. It had just occurred to me that Andy's dad had spent some unknown amount of time in a Connecticut mental hospital for exhaustion. What about the mother? She and my mom are good friends. Almost true, but not quite. Though they were on perfectly friendly terms, my mother wasn't nearly rich or connected enough for a social pages lady like Mrs. Barber. No, I mean, what does she do for a living? Charity work, I said after a disoriented pause. Like the antique show at the armory? So she's a stay-at-home mom. I nodded, glad she'd supplied the phrase so handily, which, though technically true, was not how anyone who knew Mrs. Barber would ever think to describe her. Enrique signed his name with a flourish. We'll look into it. Can't promise anything, he said, clicking his pen and sticking it back into his pocket. We can certainly drop you over with these folks for the next few hours, though, if they're who you want to be with. He slid out of the booth and walked outside. Through the front window, I could see him walking back and forth on the sidewalk, talking on the phone with a finger in one ear. Then he dialed another number for a much shorter call. There was a quick stop at the apartment, less than 5 minutes, just long enough for me to grab my school bag and a few impulsive and ill-considered items of clothing, and then back in their car again in the back seat. Are you buckled up back there? I leaned with my cheek to the cold glass and watched the lights go green all up the empty Dawn Canyon of Park Avenue. Andy lived in the upper 60s in one of the great old white glove buildings on Park, where the lobby was straight from a Dick Powell movie, and the doorman were still mostly Irish. They'd all been there forever, and as it happened, I remembered the guy who met us at the door, Kenneth, the Midnight Man. He was younger than most of the other doormen, dead pale and poorly shaven, often a bit slow on the draw from working nights. Though he was a likable guy, had sometimes mended soccer balls for Andy and me, and dispensed friendly advice on how to deal with bullies at school. He was known around the building for having a bit of a drinking problem, and as he stepped aside to usher us in through the grand doors and gave me the first of the many, "God, kid, I'm so sorry," looks I would be receiving over the next months, I smelled the sourness of beer and sleep on him. "They're expecting you," he said to the social workers. "Going up." It was Mr. Barber who opened the door. First a crack, then all the way. "Morning, morning," he said, stepping back. Mr. Barber was a tiny bit strange-looking, with something pale and silvery about him, as if his treatments in the Connecticut ding farm, as he called it, had rendered him incandescent. His eyes were a queer, unstable gray, and his hair was pure white, which made him seem older than he was until you noticed that his face was young and pink, boyish even. His ruddy cheeks and his long, old-fashioned nose, in combination with the prematurely white hair, gave him the amiable look of a lesser founding father, some minor member of the Continental Congress teleported to the 21st century. He was wearing what appeared to be yesterday's office clothes, a rumpled dress shirt and expensive-looking suit trousers that looked like he had just grabbed them off the bedroom floor. "Come on in," he said briskly, rubbing his eyes with his fist. "Hello there, dear," he said to me. The deer, startling from him, even in my disoriented state. Barefoot, he padded ahead of us through the marble foyer. Beyond, in the richly decorated living room, all glazed chintz and Chinese jars, it felt less like morning than midnight. Silk-shaded lamps burning low, big dark paintings of naval battles, and drapes drawn against the sun. "There, by the baby grand, and a flower arrangement the size of a packing case, stood Mrs. Barber in a floor-sweeping house coat, pouring coffee into cups on a silver tray. As she turned to greet us, I could feel the social workers taking in the apartment and her. Mrs. Barber was from a society family with an old Dutch name, so cool and blonde and monotone that sometimes she seemed partially drained of blood. She was a masterpiece of composure. Nothing ever ruffled her or made her upset. And though she was not beautiful, her calmness had the magnetic pull of beauty, a stillness so powerful that the molecules realigned themselves around her when she came into a room. Like a fashion drawing come to life, she turned heads wherever she went, gliding along obliviously without appearing to notice the turbulence she created in her wake. Her eyes were spaced far apart. Her ears were small, high set, and very close to her head. And her body was long-waisted and thin, like an elegant weasel's. Andy had these features as well, but in ungainly proportions, without her slinky ermine grace. In the past, her reserve, or coldness, depending how you saw it, had sometimes made me uncomfortable, but that morning I was grateful for her sang-froid. "Hi there. We'll be putting you in the room with Andy," she said to me, without beating around the bush. "I'm afraid he's not up yet for school, though. If you'd like to go to lie down for a while, you're perfectly welcome to go to Platt's room." Platt was Andy's older brother, away at school. "You know where it is, of course." I said that I did. "Are you hungry?" "No." "Well then, tell us what we can do for you." I was aware of them all looking at me. My headache was bigger than anything else in the room. In the bullseye mirror above Mrs. Barber's head, I could see the whole scene replicated in freakish miniature. Chinese jars, coffee tray, awkward-looking social workers and all. In the end, it was Mr. Barber who broke the spell. "Come along, then. Let's get you squared away," he said, clapping his hand on my shoulder and firmly steering me out of the room. "No, back here, this way. Aft, aft. Right back here." The only time I'd ever set foot in Platt's room, several years before, Platt, who was a champion lacrosse player and a bit of a psychopath, had threatened to beat the ever-living crap out of Andy and me. When he lived at home, he'd stayed in there all the time with the door closed, and, Andy told me, smoked pot. Now all his posters were gone, and the room was very clean and empty-looking since he was away at Groton. There were free weights, stacks of old National Geographics, an empty aquarium. Mr. Barber, opening and closing drawers, was babbling a bit. Let's see what's in here, shall we? Bedsheets and more bedsheets. I'm afraid I never come in here. I do hope you'll forgive me. Swimming trunks. Won't be needing those this morning, will we? Scrabbling around in yet a third drawer, he finally produced some new pajamas with the tag still on. Ugly as hell, reindeer on electric blue flannel. No mystery why they'd never been worn. Well then, he said, running a hand through his hair and cutting his eyes anxiously toward the door. I'll leave you now. Hell of a thing that's happened, good Lord. You must be feeling awfully rough. A good solid sleep will be the best thing in the world for you. Are you tired? He said, looking at me closely. Was I? I was wide awake, and yet part of me was so glassed off and numb I was practically in a coma. If you'd rather have company, perhaps if I build a fire in the other room, tell me what you want. At this question, I felt a sharp rush of despair. For as bad as I felt, there was nothing he could do for me. And from his face, I realized he knew that too. We're only in the next room if you need us. That is to say, I'll be leaving soon for work, but someone will be here. His pale gaze darted around the room, then returned to me. Perhaps it's incorrect of me, but in the circumstances, I wouldn't see the harm in pouring you what my father used to call a minor nip. If you should happen to want such a thing. Which, of course, you don't, he added hastily, noting my confusion. Quite unsuitable. Never mind. He stepped closer, and for an uncomfortable moment, I thought he might touch me or hug me. But instead, he clapped his hands and rubbed them together. In any case, we are perfectly happy to have you, and I hope you'll make yourself as comfortable as you can. You'll speak right up if you need anything, won't you? He had hardly stepped out when there was whispering outside the door. Then a knock. Someone here to see you, Mrs. Barber said, and withdrew. And in plodded Andy, blinking, fumbling with his glasses. It was clear that they had woken him up and hauled him out of bed. With a noisy creak of bed springs, he sat beside me on the edge of Platt's bed, looking not at me, but at the wall opposite. He cleared his throat, pushed his glasses up on the bridge of his nose. There followed a long silence. Urgently, the radiator clanked and hissed. Both his parents had gotten out of there so fast, it was like they'd heard the fire alarm. Wow, he said after some moments, in his eerie, flat voice. Disturbing. Yeah, I said. And together we sat in silence, side by side, staring at the dark green walls of Platt's room and the taped squares where his posters had once been. What else was there to say? Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And now I'll take questions from the audience, if anyone has any questions. No one does. What? Yes?
If I'm not mistaken, this is the second book that you've written from the point of view of a child. Do you think there's a reason that you tend to write from that point of view, or...
It is, well, this book is actually, he's remembering, it starts out when he's an adult, he's remembering his childhood, he's actually in his late 20s remembering, he's recounting the story of his life as a young man, actually in some trouble with the police, but the reason that my first book, too, was from the point of view of young people. They weren't children, but of young people, college students. And for me, I like writing about young people because for several reasons. One, because young people are just figuring things out. They're just coming into collision with the social world for the first time. They are trying to find their place in the world. They're trying to figure out how things work there. So that's actually very interesting. Because they're in the process of becoming, there are lots of interesting possibilities there. But also, just as a writer, I enjoy writing about young people and children, because for me, it's a way back into the sort of readerly excitement I had as a child. I mean, it's the experience I always want as a reader, that I'm always looking for, where you just turn the pages, turn the pages, turn the pages, that sort of galloping, sort of great joy of reading. And for me, to find my way back into that excitement, a door into that excitement, writing about young people and children helps me do that. It helps me remember my own childhood and sort of the quality of reading that I'm always going for. It's what I always want. So those two reasons are why. Yeah. Yeah.
That you feel have influenced you in your writing?
Who are some of the great writers who have influenced me in my writing? A lot. The first writer I ever really... I really loved Robert Louis Stevenson when I was a little girl. Really loved him. Read Treasure Island just over and over and over. Loved Kidnapped. I loved Edgar Allan Poe. I loved Dickens. I loved Mark Twain. Those were all early loves that have really followed me into adulthood. And when I was older, I really began to love the Russian novelists, particularly Dostoevsky, when I got a little earlier in my late teens. And I love Fitzgerald. I love Conrad. I also love a lot of humorous writers. For me, there's hardly any book that I really love that doesn't have some funny moment in it. You know, I really love Nancy Mitford. I love Ivy Compton Burnett. I love P.G. Woodhouse. I love. Those are books that I turn to and read and reread a lot. Influenced by all of them. All of them are kind of in there somewhere. Yes?
What gave you your inspiration for the main character's name, Theo?
You know, I don't know. I was asked that a lot. My book came out first in the Netherlands, and my Het Poetertje, the Goldfinch. It's a Dutch painting, and so the premiere of my book was in Holland, in Dutch language. But the Dutch were very interested in this because, of course, they were thinking about Theo van Gogh's brother, you know, who's. And I think there is something to that. I think because the Theo in my book he's not an artist himself, but he sees himself as kind of. As a custodian of art, which is a duty that he carries out indifferently at best sometimes, but that is how he sees himself. And so I think that was probably in the back of my mind, something that a Dutch reporter pointed out to me too that I didn't see or think of at all. But Theo Dekker Dana Tart. He said that, and he was like, T-D-D-T, same number of letters. And I thought, I didn't do that. I didn't do that on purpose. I really didn't. I did not do that. But nonetheless, it's there. And when you ask me a question like that, I don't know. But I was surprised when he pointed that out. But yeah, I don't know. It was nothing I did on purpose. But yeah, he does have inverse of my initials. So anyway. That's all I have to say about Theo's name. Yes?
At the High Museum in Atlanta.
Oh, good for you. Yeah,
well, and it was great because then the stories about your book came out. And I was like, oh, I've seen that painting. So I wondered what your relationship is with that painting and how you chose it for the book.
I first saw that painting as a copy in Christie's Amsterdam, a 19th century copy, and a really pretty good 19th century copy. And I liked it even as a copy. I thought it's a wonderful, wonderful little painting, and it's really tiny. I actually saw it yesterday. The show just opened in New York, and I went to it. But it's very small. And if you saw it in the room, I mean, there are all those big Dutch paintings, and there's this tiny little thing. It's very different looking. It's really an anomaly. It's like nothing from that age of art, but it's very interesting to write about Fabricius because he was a very great painter and very celebrated in his own day, but he was the pupil of Rembrandt, and he was Rembrandt's most famous pupil. Rembrandt was extremely famous in his own day. Rembrandt was famous from the time he was about 25 years old until this very night. He started painting, and we've known his name ever since. But and Fabricius was his most famous pupil. I mean, and this is in a age when painters greatly valued, and he was very, very highly thought of. But he died very young in a sort of a terrible accident. The gunpowder factory exploded in Delft in 1654, and it blew up half the city, and it destroyed just countless amounts of art, but it also killed Fabricius and destroyed most of his work. Vermeer lived in Delft. Vermeer was Fabricius's pupil. Insofar as we really know Fabricius's work very much at all, it's through his influence on Vermeer. If you put Vermeer and Fabricius side by side, you can see the kinship between them and Rembrandt and Fabricius. But if you look at Rembrandt and Vermeer, you think, these two painters don't look anything like each other. Fabricius used all sort of Rembrandt's great sort of impasto quality, sort of piling on the paint, very, very thick. Also really good at illusionistic effects. But he's not dark like Rembrandt is. It's light. It's sunlight. That bird is against a sunny, bright wall. You don't really have quite that quality of light in Dutch art. Well, we know it through Vermeer because insofar as we know Fabricius's work, it's really through Vermeer, who wasn't famous in his own day either. I mean, who became famous in the 1890s, really. His work was really rediscovered. But Fabricius was so wonderful it was interesting to write a book. I have people asking me all the time, is this a real painting? That they think I made the painting up because it's not really very famous. There are only maybe half a dozen paintings of Fabricius that survived. They're rare, 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 the rarest of the rare. And of them, the Goldfinch is the greatest one. And it makes you wonder what the rest of his work looked like. But in a way, the fact that the painting is so little known outside Holland, it's very famous in Holland, but not quite so famous everywhere else, it was almost like I was writing about some mythical painter in a Borges story. You know, he could almost be imaginary because it would have been much harder to write a book and much less appealing to me about a great name that was more widely known. I mean, there's a sort of ghostly quality about him that made it interesting for me to and Fabricius himself really appears kind of as a ghost through the book and as not a literal ghost but a figurative ghost, and he's there until the very end. I mean, Theo is a bit haunted by him and haunted by this story, and that story is sort of a running counter to his own story throughout the book. Yes?
Since it's a long time between books for you, would you tell us a little bit about the process? Does the concept come, or do you struggle with the concept and then the book comes quickly, or do you go through a lot of rewrites? Sort of the process of your writing.
I write a lot. I write by hand, first of all, and I write a lot. I keep notebooks, and even though I write a lot, not everything that I write ends up in a finished book. I think it was Brahms who said, composition is easy. What's hard is having to throw most of what you write away. I began taking notes for this, what I didn't know it was this book, but I started writing about Amsterdam 1993, about 20 years ago. And some of the Amsterdam portions of this book were written as long ago as 20 years ago. But I didn't have any idea that they would be part of a novel someday, or part of a finished novel. I have lots of things like that in notebooks that don't actually wind up becoming books. But lots of different things came together in just the right way. There wasn't one idea everything came together. I mean, something that was actually at the bottom of it, and I can't say why exactly, but it had to do with the fact that I think that I wrote something about art and the destruction of art was when the great Buddhas at Bamiyan were destroyed before 9/11. That was it was the thing that happened before 9/11 that was slightly the precursor to 9/11, the sort of pre-shock before 9/11, and incredibly, I can't say why that really was the event. I don't know why it came out. The story came out. Why that was the germ of what made me write this story. In a funny way, I mean, I work so much from my unconscious that I don't really question why I write what I write too much. I think it's not always a very good idea, but I do know that it's not a good idea for me to analyze it in a way, because I don't analyze it. It comes out in fiction. That's where the impulse to write fiction comes from, is from not analyzing it, and then it processes itself and it comes out in a novel. But definitely that was the thing. That's the reason this is a book about art, and it's not a book about law or a book about medicine or about music. That was the catalyst. That was the thing. Yes? No, I think somebody was scratching their nose back there. Hi. A comfort with?
I wouldn't say comfort, but like an understanding sort of ease. It wasn't like in the chain of events that lead to it.
Well, what I was hoping to do in The Secret History, I was hoping that the reader would identify with the narrator to some extent, and to some extent be making those choices along with the narrator. And then all of a sudden to look up and, where am I? What have I done? You know, it was a way of, because it was, there wasn't in The Secret History, and it often happens that way with evil and with evil acts, that there's a great book written by Gita Sereni called Into That Darkness. She interviewed a concentration camp commandant named Franz Stangl, about who was caught later on, and he really talked to her. He told the truth about what he did and why he did it. And the chilling thing about it is, just at some point he looked up and I'm just in something I didn't understand. Just how slowly it happened it's the old Al Gore metaphor of the frog being boiled to death, the frog in a pan of water, and it just keeps getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter, and then the frog just doesn't realize it until it's too late. But Yeah, with Franz Stangl, it was very interesting because the first thing they asked him to do, he was a Catholic, first thing they asked him to do, well, you're a member of the Nazi Party, you have to sort of renounce the Catholic faith. And he didn't really want to do it, but it was his job, and he did it. And it just little thing like that after little thing, and just it you know, wound up being something horrible. But it's about those, really, it's about those tiny decisions across along the way, because they're actually all important. You know, even the ones that don't seem important, they are. I'll take one more question. Yes.
On the back of your comment about having written passages in Amsterdam, about Amsterdam, mm-hmm.
Very, very strongly. Very strongly. All my books, in some sense, really began with place, with a sense of place. Even with my first book, The Secret History, before I really had an idea of the secret history, it really began very much with mood, with being away at school, a strange, snowy place, the feel of certain, you know, empty white rooms, and it was ink stains on my hands and smell of damp wool and just a lot of very sensory impressions of that place and of the newness of it, the strangeness of it. That was, and actually something I have in common with my Bennington classmate, Brett Easton Ellis. I mean, because that, when we started out writing together, we started writing our books about the same time. We were about the same age. And Less Than Zero is that, too. Less Than Zero is all about place. It's all about California. It's a certain sort of sun-blinded California mood. It was, that book really came out of mood, too. But that's certainly true of The Little Friend, of my second book, my Mississippi book. And yes, with this book, before I had any story at all, I was very captivated with sort of a dark Amsterdam mood on the one hand, but on the other, a kind of creepy Park Avenue, a very sort of stale, claustrophobic, rich, sort of spoiled kind of Park Avenue mood. And New York, New Amsterdam, those were the two poles of the novel, Amsterdam and New York. But it wasn't quite hanging together, and I didn't know why. The book wasn't working. And I'd written for 2 or 3 years, and it was oddly a chance trip to Las Vegas that I didn't really particularly want to take. That it's really good that I did. It was a good lesson that you should sometimes do the things that you think that you won't enjoy, because that's actually the thing that will make all the difference. I was walking through a casino, and I saw an exhibition of paintings. They have real paintings there, you know, the exhibition of... It's such an interesting thing, because so much in everything in Las Vegas is fake. There's the Eiffel Tower, and there's, you know, right next door to the Grand Canal that smells like chlorine water, and the canal is on the second floor. Gondoliers, it is. And then you can see the pyramids from the window in New York, New York, across the street. Everything is fake, and the disorientation of being in that desert landscape where just all these sorts of bits and broken pieces of civilization kind of all jammed up together, but really all wrong, and just like a different planet, very, very strange. But then walking through the Bellagio and seeing an exhibition of real French Impressionists, Bonnard, Vuillard, the real thing, and to see real art, real painting, real beauty in that particular context bing, 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 bing. Everything started to fire. Everything, the novel really began to come into place because it made me think of all sorts of notions of luck and chance and money and the movement of money. I mean, art has always had to do with dirty money, always, always, always. And that was the real, yes, it was the middle passageway. And again, that wasn't a place that I had any connection with at all or ever would have thought of, but it was that chance trip of going there. And I since, you know, spent sort of an eccentric amount of time in Las Vegas. It was sort of an odd amount. I went back several times. But it was, I don't know, it's interesting because my old writing teacher, Barry Hanna, used to talk about writing about place, and for him that place was almost always the South. But he also, and for me it's always been important, you can write about place being a Southerner and being somewhere else, being sort of an exiled Southerner, and having place strike you as an outsider, feeling different and feeling off balance and not at home where you are. And so in a lot of my writing about place has had to do with that feeling, you know, not being in my own place, being in some different place and having the newness of it strike me. But I have to say it's really great to be here tonight. This is the closest I'm going to get to Mississippi on my this book tour is Tennessee. So it feels very fitting that I'm in Nashville for the debut of this book. And thank you. Thank you all for coming.